From a snowy seacoast, New Hampshire, is Josh Nason's Punch-Out. Hi, everyone. My name is Josh Nason, contributing editor for WrestlingObserver.com. Welcome back. Hope you guys are doing well. Yes, it's true. Two episodes in 1 week. Imagine that, right? Haven't done that in a long time, but a lot of stuff going on this week, and a lot of things are kind of rattling around in my brain that I want to chat about. A couple days ago, released an episode with MMA fighting Steven Morocco talking about UFC 257, some Conor McGregor stuff, and then also Steven's excellent feature on Spencer Fisher that just came out. So we chatted about that, so you can listen to that right now. And this episode, a little bit different. A lot of stuff going on in the business world of pro wrestling with the NBCU, Peacock, WWE deal that got announced on, I think it was Monday at this point. It seems like weeks ago. But yeah, the big news that the WWE Network, at least in the U.S., is going to move to NBC's streaming service that is called Peacock. And I know that Dave and other people have talked about it a lot. However, I wanted to get a different perspective about it. So I went to one of the guys that's really known for this type of analysis and a past guest of the show, Brandon Thurston. So Brandon and I talked for a little over an hour all about this, and we tried to hit some different angles with it. I didn't try to go kind of the general questions that everyone kind of already knows some of the answers to, but we tried to take a couple different angles with this. So I think, you know, if you're into this stuff, this will be well worth your listen and not fully repetitive, put it that way. That was my intent going into this. And I also talked a little bit about last week's Undertaker Joe Rogan interview, which was fresh in my mind. I finally finished it. And from someone that Brandon is a indie wrestler, I wanted to chat with him about basically, you know, his perspective on some of the stuff that Undertaker said and so on. So enjoy this. Is again, long conversation, but it's a very good conversation. Myself, Brandon Thurston of WrestleNomics, talking about WWE, Peacock, and a little bit of The Undertaker. Enjoy. Well, I tell you what, folks, sometimes I need to have a show booker because some of these guests are so in demand, it's tough to get. And that, luckily, I was able to do this one myself. Pulled a few strings, talked to a few people, greased a few palms, and he's here. The doctor of WrestleNomics, just made that up a few seconds ago. Brandon Thurston returns to Josh Nason's Punch-Out, a man that has been all over the place today. You've been there the past couple of days, post-wrestling, I've noticed. Fightful with the dastardly Sean Ross Sapp, and all that. But yeah, man, this is I guess it's good to be you because you built up this this subject matter for yourself, subject matter expert. And when things like, you know, a big streaming deal happens, WWE and everything, people come to you first. That's good.
Yes, you worked it out with my agent. I understand there are a lot of negotiations, but you know, he's doing what's best for me. But I've been on the tour of the wrestling media ecosystem today and yesterday. But no, it's a lot of fun. I was thinking, I think the first time I ever appeared on a podcast of any kind in my life was on Josh Nason's Punch Out.
Really?
I think so. It was before Royal Rumble. Yeah. I was very nervous.
Oh, you were. I was trying to, because I was looking it up and I didn't put your name in the headline initially. And I'm like, which date was that? So yeah, it had to be.
It was right before, it was the Rumble that Triple H won. So that's 2016, it's got to be, because then he went on to face Roman Reigns at the Texas Stadium.
It was that long ago? Wow.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah. Man. Well, here we are again.
Yes, and now I've had exposure therapy, and I'm much more relaxed now.
That's good. And you and I have actually met since then.
Yes, we met at Limitless Wrestling in Portland, Maine.
Damn right.
I think that's – do you live in Maine? Where do you – what state do you live in?
I live in New Hampshire. I am from Maine originally, but I live in New Hampshire about an hour and 10 minutes away from where you competed that night.
Okay. So that, I think that was the first time I was ever in the state of Maine, I think. I haven't been back since, but the pandemic happened and I haven't wrestled since March, right? Yeah, maybe March or February. Yeah, but it's been fine because I'm not getting any younger and, you know, I was training two nights a week, but I'm starting to miss that finally.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at your Twitter earlier, and you had put together, I think it's pinned, your pinned tweet, you had your highlight reel from 2019 was the top, and you're looking forward to a very optimistic 2020. Of course, everyone that's done indie wrestling just kind of had their year blown to shit. You know, it's been picking up a little bit lately, but obviously there's just so many things you have to think about and all that stuff. So yeah, you've had to kind of put it on ice for a while, huh?
Yeah, you got to put out those new year positive, I'm going to kick ass in the new year tweets, and 2020 is my year. And no, it wasn't. It wasn't anybody's year except for maybe Patton. McAfee, how do you say his name? Yeah.
Pat McAfee. That's right. Yes. Yeah. What a year. But you're, I think about you a lot when I see any of the Buffalo guys get on AEW or on Dark or, you know, a lot of those guys, or even, I was watching, the Limitless Vacationland Cup and Daniel Garcia, was in the finals there. And Ken Blackwood, Blackwood was on that card, but he made it on Dark, and then Puff was on there. And obviously, there was Megabyte Ronnie was on, and so there's so many guys. All of a sudden, there was a run a few months ago, and obviously, there's connection with Pepper Parks the Butcher and the Blade.
The Blade.
That's right.
Yes,
the Blade and the Butcher, Mr. Williams, and it's been a good year in terms of wrestling on the bigger scene for Buffalo.
Yeah, those younger guys, the Buffalo Brothers, are still getting out, and like you said, I did catch the Vacation Land tournament. I did catch part of that. Randy from Limitless loves those guys. And they did Dark recently. And so Pepper Parks, now known as The Blade, and his partner, The Butcher, Andy Williams. So he's from a suburb, I guess, between Niagara Falls and Buffalo called North Tonawanda, which is where I grew up as well. And he's quite a bit older than me. I will out him, but he was in the same backyard that I was in. We were like the younger kids who got powerbomb onto mattresses a lot because we were small and easier to pick up.
Yeah.
But, and they were the older, cooler kids who did the really hardcore stuff, like destroying their bodies hard ground. And he has some really terrible stories about somebody like having to be hospitalized after something stupid. But yeah, we from Extreme Gratwick Wrestling. Gratwick is a neighborhood within North Tonawanda. So yes, a lot of us go way back with Andy Williams. But I'm glad to see the Buffalo guys get out, and there may or may not be a W tryout happening this week.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Interesting. Any details you can give on that?
I don't know. I think there might be one of the Buffalo Brothers at a W tryout this week.
I see. Good stuff. Well, I guess speaking of Buffalo, are you going to give, I have a new revenue stream for you if you want one. Perhaps you can tell some of these, the Bills Mafia, how to take better bumps through tables and all the things they're doing. Is that something you might be interested in doing?
Yeah. I'm part of the, wrestling school in Buffalo, Grapplers Anonymous. And there was a time, last year's NFL season where they actually took the ring down to Orchard Park and, where people are tailgating and set up the ring did all sorts of stuff. I was never a part of it, but, a lot of the wrestlers who trained with us were, and I think that was part of, there's some radio station involved. And I think that was kind of the idea is that we're going to show you how to properly, I don't know, go through a table or something like that. But yeah. Yes, but we won't have any people throwing themselves through tables at Raymond James Stadium. Maybe on April 10th and 11th, though.
Exactly. Available only on Peacock in the United States.
That's right. Only on NBC Universal's Peacock.
What a segue that was, huh?
Yes.
That's excellent. Good stuff. So I was mentioning that you've done a lot of interviews. We'll get into kind of some of the stuff that maybe people that haven't heard those are thinking about and stuff that, you know, Dave hasn't talked about or whatever. But I want to ask you, is there anything that you haven't been asked or haven't got a chance to kind of talk about with regards to what we know yesterday and kind of what we maybe know a little bit more of today with this whole deal? Is there something that's still kind of like you still haven't kind of figured out or something you haven't been asked yet? Or what do you think?
Well, I've just been doing some research and tweeting, and I had not done the math until just an hour ago or so. Just looking at a lot of this decision today or yesterday that came out was about, you know, this is really a year in the making, and it's really a decision that Vince McMahon made at a fork in the road about a year ago to get rid of Berrios and Wilson, George Berrios and Michelle Wilson, who were the co-presidents of WWE at the time, and to ultimately end up getting Nick Khan to be the president and chief revenue officer. And it's about a decision about whether or not Vince was going to go forward with the Berrios and Wilson idea of doing a premium tier. So basically a tier of the WWE network that would be maybe $15 or $20, or whether ultimately what Vince decided is that he wanted to not do that and just try to sell the rights to a major streaming player. And I did the math anyway. And what I found out, and this, a lot of this is, I'm making some assumptions here to get to numbers that have not been reported, but what we do know is that the deal is worth $1 billion over 5 years. So I've applied a 10% escalation from year to year and try to imagine, you know, let's be really generous to the idea of a premium tiered network. And let's say 50% of the subscribers in the U.S. go premium and go to $19.99. I think that's being generous. And let's say the other half stay at $9.99. And you still end up with a total of $204 million on an annual basis, which is only in the middle of what the value of the deal is for NBCU Peacock. So that's, you know, we know that it's $1 billion over five. So that means it's $200 million on an average annual basis. So it gives me more confirmation that, yeah, I think, you know, I you can criticize Vince for a lot of things related to the creative side of the business, but, you know, it looks like he made the right decision here as far as, you know, I think that's clearly what the disruption was between Vince and the co-presidents. And he's getting a better deal for himself here. And with more certainty, this is just a contract that's going to guarantee them about $200 million every year for the next 5 years. Whether or not there's any incentives for WWE, I would hope so. If I'm NBC Universal, I hope I'm incentivizing WWE to put on good shows. But he made the right strategy choice a year ago, it looks like today.
Yeah, when the deal got announced and they said this is going to come out in March, I think that I don't know, maybe people didn't really think, like, when is this deal happening? I don't think it happened like in the last couple of weeks, because that's a lot of infrastructure and a lot of things to move. These are yeah, decisions, to your point. And I think you're right on with the inflection point was probably, you know, the Berrios Wilson, the fork in the road you're mentioning. And that would make sense that they would have been playing this for a year. And I'm curious, you know, there's always kind of the curiosity of what other players they could have been talking to, you know, what makes sense and all that. But, you know, NBCU and this Peacock service does, you know, it does make sense. And you have all these services competing against each other that they're just trying to get like IP that is familiar, right? And they're trying to buy subscribers. That's one of the reasons that, you know, ESPN wanted UFC so badly, was because they had this built-in audience and audiences that were conditioned to pay just because of the nature of the business, right? So they were able to bring those on, and that was a, you know, nice jumping off point for, you know, what that service has become. And, you know, pay-per-view buying issues aside, it's been I'm they're thrilled with the deal, and I'm, you know, interesting stuff down the road there. But WWE, you know, it's like they have this built-in audience, and does it, you know, where does it make a fit? And they've had this relationship forever with NBCU and have, you know, relatively recently with Fox, but Fox doesn't really have a traditional like streaming service like Peacock that they have to go to right now. So it makes a lot of sense. I'm very curious, like who else would have made sense, would have seemed like a natural fit. You know, could you see it on a Prime? Could you see it on a, you know, some of these other services? Netflix didn't really seem like a good thing. So Peacock, who's kind of just still young in this game and looking to get any type of attention it can, other than for The Office, this seemed, from a branding standpoint and familiarity standpoint, it seemed to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think ESPN Plus was the only other real player here. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they, you know, talked to a variety of others. But I think this is according to Dave Meltzer's reporting last year spring, is that Vince was talking to ESPN Plus, but then the pandemic happened. Vince even, so a week after Berrios and Wilson left, he had an earnings call to do, and he made it sound like a deal was very close to getting done.
I remember that.
He said, yeah, because we won't even see it by the end of Q1. That's how far along we are. And but then the pandemic happened in the middle of March, and that probably caused a lot of economic uncertainty for Disney, which is ESPN's parent. So, I imagine that they probably continued to talk to ESPN Plus as time went on. And I really think that probably the time between the beginning of COVID and when Nick Khan came, I imagine there was less action happening. But Nick Khan is, that's what he's there to do. He's the one who helped them get the current US TV deals that they have. And this is his area of expertise, is making good media deals. So, you know, I think there was a report by Laura Martin from Needham, who covers W stock, where she, at one point, and I think she was just speculating that maybe Amazon would buy the rights or buy the company. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think that's something that was anywhere near close to happening. I think Disney isn't the greatest brand match there. I don't think Disney would want to get into WWE. I don't think HBO Max would do it, probably because of the conflict of interest there with Warner Media and their partnership with AEW. So I would guess, again, that Peacock and ESPN Plus, which is kind of what I felt all along, were just the most obvious choices. I guess something else that I'm seeing, and I don't know what to make of, is some concern about, all right, we're going to put WWE content on Peacock, on this mainstream brand streaming service. And there's a lot of questionable WWE content over the years that's in that library. And what happens if the wrong person sees something and says something publicly about it on Twitter or whatever? I don't know. I wonder how seriously to take that. And I guess the first question is all the library going to be on Peacock? I figured it probably would be.
It sounds like it is, yeah. From what Dave said, Dave said that what he was told is all 17,000 hours that are up are moving over. And that was my impression from all the media and everything I saw, is that literally it's like point A is now moving to point B. Your access point is going to be different, require you to, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but basically it's just the same network here, the same network over here, just a different access point.
Right, and I do think that's in the press release, and you know that the tens of thousands of hours, the WN Peacock catalog has 47,000 hours. Yeah, I think there is a mention of sort of referring to the size of W's library and that it's going to be included in Peacock. But I don't know. It is a different situation than you know just being a direct to consumer service.
Right.
WE's handling. Now that said, the other thing is that. This is not unlike the deal that WWE has with Rogers in Canada to host the network. This is not unlike the deal that WWE has, which is a relatively new deal, though, with Sony in India. But I don't know. I guess the U.S. is not Canada, and the U.S. is definitely not India. But I don't know. Maybe there is a PR issue with NBC is going to be the one that's hosting this stuff. So. I don't know. I don't. I'm totally ambivalent about how seriously to think about that. But yeah.
I think they kind of know. NBC knows who they're getting into bed with because they've been in bed with them for a long time. So I think if there was any type of trepidation, I think it probably would have taken care of that. If there was questionable stuff, I think it's going to be like quietly removed, and it's going to take somebody noticing it and be like, hey, where's this?
Yeah, but doesn't Disney have like the Gone with the Wind isn't, which I think Disney owns the rights to, right? Mm-hmm. And but if you try to play Gone with the Wind, whatever, I think it's on Disney. What comes up first is like some sort of discussion about the racial issues that are apparent in the movie. And I would like to see maybe some WWE pay-per-views from the late 90s that start with a serious discussion with Stephanie McMahon and others about feminism and things of that nature.
Or when like Triple H dressed up like Mark Henry in blackface, right?
Oh,
on Raw, you remember that?
There you go. Mm-hmm. There's just one example.
Yeah. It was X-Pac dressing up as Mark Henry and
yes.
Triple H
they're
was
all,
yeah, they all
blackface essentially, right?
Yeah, they were. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
90s were the roaring 90s, right?
Good times, yeah. that's when the business was at its peak.
That's right, yeah. Brother. That's right. So the so accessibility. So this is one of the things that hadn't really been mentioned a lot. And then I heard it brought up, and then I was kind of noticing going through apps on my TVs. And I Peacock is, you can't, like, I can't find on my Samsung TV, and I can't find on my other smart TV. So now I have to try to figure out a way to, but WWE Network is there. Now I have to figure out a way to stream it there. If it's a Chromecast or Apple TV, something, Roku, some other way that I'm able to get up there. But that's an extra step. And yeah. Whenever
there's no Peacock app on your smart TV.
No, there's not. Cause I looked, and my TV is not that, it's like 2 years old. There's no, it's weird. So, and maybe it could have been loaded up recently. I think I looked maybe like a month ago and I didn't see it, but, regardless, anytime that you change a service, you're going to have people that are like, no matter what, they're going to come along, right? Your hardcores, for any type of move, but then you're going to have people that it's going to give them that chance to be like, huh, do I even need this anymore? It's one of these like mindless charges on your credit card that you don't notice until you're ready to take a look at it. And you're like, why am I paying for this? Why am I doing this? And they may think, okay, if they're not a Comcast subscriber getting it for free, if they're not a Charter and getting it for free, and they're like, yeah, even at $5, like, do we even need this anymore? And I wonder, that's one thing, is I wonder how many are going to be shaved off by the move because they're like, I just don't need it anymore. There's a question of how many are currently Comcast and Charter subscribers and are going to get this for free and whether that changes their adoption rates and their interest level and all that. And then just also the people are like, nah, I'm good. And they're going to be done completely. So, because I don't think it's going to be like and I don't think in any move, there's never a perfect 100% move changeover. There's always going to be some sort of issues there. So I'm curious about how that plays out, and it's nothing they can really avoid. It's just I'm used to getting my cookies out of this jar, and now it's a different jar, and now the jar is up on a shelf, and I have to think about it now, you know?
Yeah, I think we're talking about what my favorite tech and media podcasts call friction, where you're being, as a consumer, you're being asked to do something that's different or even take extra clicks to do something that you're used to having get done more easily. I guess it all comes down to how seamless the execution of this migration will be. I mean, like, ideally, maybe W Network apps on your operating system, on your TV or your streaming device will just one day in March be replaced with a Peacock app. I don't know that that's going to happen, but it does sound like your user account is just going to be migrated over to Peacock. That sounds like it's going to happen, but this sounds a little bit more user friendly than I thought it would be when I was thinking about this a year ago when Vince was talking about, you know, doing this, and that it's not as if the network just closes and then you have to independently go on your own and create a new user account and sign up all over again. That would lead to a lot of fallout of subscribers. So I don't think it's going to be nearly that bad, but it may lead some people to think about whether or not they can want to continue to pay for this. I guess one of the incentives though is that, look, you're getting access. You're not paying anything more. That's a good thing. If anything, you might pay less. If you're willing to see ads, you'll pay half the price and you'll get access to everything else that's on Peacock. I was just scrolling through it an hour or so ago, and there's a ton of stuff on there, like Little House on the Prairie and Murder, She Wrote. So it should be right up the alley of the average linear TV viewer for WWE. But I don't know. There's a lot of stuff on there. So you're getting more content for the same or less price. So, but it might lead people to think about whether they want to keep it. I guess if I'm Peacock, though, if I lose a lot of if I feel like I haven't converted everybody who is on the W Network over to Peacock, I don't know if I would have a panic attack. I think this is all just a really long-term investment for NBC Universal. In that, you know, a lot of the in my Twitter replies, I see a lot of, you know, anxiety and criticism. I think it's, you know, I see a lot of people saying, oh my God, why are they overpaying for all these W Network subscribers. And it's just, it's the fact of Comcast and NBC Universal are a much larger company than WWE, and they have a much bigger business at stake in that they're a, you know, Comcast is a cable company, among other things. NBC Universal is a set of cable networks, among other things. And it's really important to them that in this media ecosystem where cable subscriptions are on the decline indefinitely, that they start to gather some sort of streaming consumer activity that belongs to them, that they may not, you know, their streaming service Peacock may not be profitable in year one or year two, but 10 years from now, they're probably going to really need that streaming service to replace the increasing loss of revenue from cable subscriptions.
I remember people clutching their pearls in the early months of Disney Plus, the early months, like this was like 20 years ago, right? But you follow the same people that I do a lot in the space, in the streaming space, and they talk about this, and they were, you know, Disney's going to lose us all this money and all this stuff. And I was just thinking, like, this is, sure. I mean, this is Disney. Like, they get this stuff, and I had faith because, one, they've built this incredible worldwide business, right? They didn't screw up Marvel. They enhanced it. Everything, the Star Wars, they were able to figure that out, you know, to the extent the Star Wars fans, you have some disagreement there. But that I knew because I have a young daughter. She was 3 at the time that Disney Plus launched, and my friends have similar ages, kids of similar ages. And we knew based on Moana. We knew based on The Little Mermaid. We knew based on Cinderella and Frozen and all these things that these are things that we have to either right now before Disney Plus, we had to rent or we had to, we had to buy outright. And we knew for a very low price per month, we were going to be able to have that stuff and everything else within just, you know, 2 clicks. Right. So I knew it was going to be a big success because of that. And obviously it's been a tremendous success, and it's only been exacerbated by the pandemic because we've been kind of, you know, all stuck at home. You know, I think with Peacock, it needs like any streaming service, it needs hooks. You know, Netflix's hooks early on were House of Cards. They were like Breaking Bad, you know, when Breaking Bad was available there in full. You know, all the Orange is the New Black, all these shows, and they were hooks. And all of a sudden, then people like, well, what's this? And what's this? And what's this? So Peacock, obviously, they have a struggle or a fight on their hands in order to get that attention away from these already established players. But yeah, but for them, it makes sense. And I've heard the same thing about the overpaying because it's, you know, $200 million compared to, yeah, I think it's what, $67 million or something like that WWE gets in revenue, or had in revenue last year. I believe that might be in that ballpark. But, you know, they're just thinking, we need attention. We need to start building bases. And if we can bring this WWE base over, that's an available fan base that we can kind of check off the list. And now, you know, what else can we find, and how does, you know, this NBC Sports Network closure play into that? You know, how does the NHL, how do these other partners play into it, where people get more familiar with apps? All of a sudden, you know, they WWE fans are over, they're more familiar with it, and all of a sudden, you know, maybe some crossover with NHL fans, and all of a sudden, you know, more NHL stuff, they're like, oh yeah, this is easy, and it just kind of spreads from there. You just got to give people, you know, places to watch, and there's not a lot of available big widely known IP that people can just, the companies can just buy. And it, to me, it makes a lot of sense for Medusa. Did they overpay? Of course they did, but that's the way it is now.
Yeah, I agree. So I guess one of the things I hear talked about is how maybe, and it probably will, WrestleMania will probably be watched by more people maybe than ever. This service has something like, I see 22 sometimes I see 26, I don't know, a million user accounts are active on Peacock. I don't know how much of that is just the Comcast or Cox customers or what, but it'll probably be the most viewed WrestleMania ever because you'll have a lot of people who at least have access to it. I'm sure a small percentage of them will actually watch it, but a lot more people than ever will have access to it, right? It's sort of like, in some ways, not exactly, but in some ways, like putting WrestleMania on TV, on linear TV, in that if you put WrestleMania on a cable network that's in 20 some odd million homes, maybe more people will watch it than ever. But I don't know what this, if this, I'm not so confident that this is going to, you know, accelerate WWE's popularity. I think the popularity is driven more than anything by the star power and the quality of the content. And that's something that's down to Vince McMahon. And you can do a lot of things with the business strategies that are good and that enhance your ability to grow revenue. But what's really going to raise all the boats at once is the popularity of the content. And pandemic, no crowds doesn't help. But you know, I haven't had faith in Vince for a good 5 years now to do something that enhances the popularity and enhances the consumer metrics. And this brings up another point, is that this deal separates WWE and Vince from consumer behavior, from the immediate choices of their fans. If I cancel W Network, all right, that means they're not going to get $10. If we all cancel W Network, that means they're not going to get a lot of money. But now they're getting that revenue replaced with guaranteed revenue from another business partner. And their biggest source of revenue is from their TV rights fees, which are guaranteed and are not dependent on their viewership. And they get, you know, in non-pandemic times, $100 million from Saudi Arabia to go there, regardless of how popular their product is. So it allows the company and at least Vince to separate themselves evermore from having to, I think, maybe take seriously any sort of fan responses. But it separates you from when the content or when the consumer metrics get less popular. You can tell yourself a story that, yeah, but I'm making more money than ever. And they are. And on, you know, on February 4th, they're going to report their most profitable year ever. And there's no reason to think that, you know, for the next few years to come, most of those years are going to break that record, because these TV deals and media rights deals like this one are guaranteed to escalate over time. And NBCU Peacock giving them guaranteed money is only going to further assure that.
Yeah, it's almost like you're looking at my notes, because that was the next one up. Oh. is the insulation factor. And I think you hit it right there, is that it's, and I think I saw this in a discussion. It might have been a tweet between Bix and Voices of Wrestling, I think. Kind of just that, and I to paraphrase, I can't even paraphrase it, but it was kind of talking about that. And I mean, you bring up good points. Is this, I feel like they've insulated themselves. I think with the last TV deals, that was kind of the last shove off the dock, so to speak, right? And fans, and I've said this for a while, and it says with UFC as well, fans don't matter. And it's weird to say that, but in a lot of ways, I mean, to your point, I mean, they've made deals in the past couple of years. I mean, a billion here, a billion here, a billion here, just like that, you know. And it's like they make so much more money. They can literally do whatever they want. They could pay whoever they want. They can buy whoever they want. They have it all. And it's astounding, because they kind of live in this wrestling bubble and hear the frustrations of fans and watch the product and see the ratings numbers go down year over year. And it's like, there's no way to spend that. But it's crazy, because like this metric keeps going down, but yet the most important one, revenue, keeps going up. It doesn't make any sense, but it's just, this is the world that we're in. But you're right. I mean, Vince can be like, look, people can say I'm old and don't know what I'm doing at all, but look at the numbers. But like, the numbers are, they are what they are. You can't lie about them. And even if the consumer, it's amazing that no matter what, no matter how much we complain and complain about John Cena 3 years and Roman Reigns and this isn't booked right and this finish sucks and 3 hours of Raw and 3 hours of Raw and all this stuff, that, you know, it ultimately, it didn't matter. Vince just wins. He wins, and he's just, everything just worked out. It's incredible.
Yeah. So I think fans, they I don't know if they don't matter, but it seems like they don't. I think they matter, but it takes a longer time to feel the effects of their sentiment. So WWE is more profitable than ever, not because of anything that they've done internally so much as the external media economy that they live in, where cable subscriptions are falling, and that's created all sorts of anxiety in these major media companies. So the most popular content, which includes WWE, and to be fair to them, or to be generous to them, they have maintained a sufficient level of popularity. I mean, Raw last night was the most viewed program on cable in the key demo. So they're still highly ranked, and those most viewed cable programs, or most viewed programs generally in TV, are going to continue to be, you know, the big winners in TV rights fees. But that's largely an external factor. They're popular enough, but, you know, there's a lot of frustration. I think there's a lot of fans who have checked out. And I think the metrics, the consumer metrics that I've looked at and studied closely, for the last several years, including not just, TV ratings, which are hard to interpret. TV ratings are down, but everybody's TV ratings are down. But since 2019, Raw has declined as a, and this is a crazy metric to talk about, but as a percentage of cable viewership overall. So I'm trying to adjust it for the total volume of cable viewing. But as a percentage of cable viewing overall, Raw has been on the decline since 2019. And that's happened in 2022. You want to blame it on the pandemic, but you can't blame the pandemic for 2019. Mm. SmackDown's apparently done better, but SmackDown's been moved around to increasingly better networks, time slots, and so forth. But that's TV. That's a complicated story. But attendance has fallen since 2017 on an annual basis. Now, obviously, we didn't have much of any attendance in 2020, but merchandise has fallen since 2017 or so. It's a more complicated story in 2020, though. But I see Google web search on a consistent decline from 2016 and forward, and even a new media platform like the W Network throughout 2019 in year-over-year comparisons, because there's a lot of seasonality, right, with the W Network because it peaks around the time of WrestleMania. But in those year-over-year comparisons for four or five quarters in a row, the subscriber numbers throughout the world, both the U.S. and international, had been on the decline. So I think there's not much of a case otherwise. That, and Vince, you know, said that, you know, in response to some questions about the TV ratings, that we've got more fans really than ever because there's so much other consumption, digital and social and so forth and things of that nature. But I think there's a lot of social media and digital engagement with WWE, but the consumer metrics where people actually have to pay money, those are down. And I don't know what Vince, in the privacy of his own mind, really believes, but no, the consumer metrics are down, and it's less popular, and it takes a long time for, if you don't want to, you know, see what's really happening, it takes a long time for the change in fan sentiment, and I think in this case, the frustration of fans, to really take effect. And now we've even seen talent start to get dissatisfied too. And all of this, I think, leads to an opportunity that shouldn't even be there if you're WWE, which is AEW. I don't think AEW can exist if you haven't got a significant portion of disenfranchised fans. And it helps to have some disenfranchised talent too. And there's a lot of other conditions that are necessary for AEW to be the degree of success that it is. But one of them is an opportunity that Vince himself allowed to come into existence. Mm.
Very true. And we are WrestlingObserver.com, so we're contractually obligated to shoehorn AEW into any conversation. Yes. I don't know if you saw that in the contract I sent over. But
And they are ahead in the key demo. They're leading the key demo.
That's true.
Which is the only thing that matters.
I saw your tweet about the the Brady Mahomes.
Josh Allen, I don't care about Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers. They draw the old people, and the old people don't matter. You want to sell vitamins to them, go ahead. But Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes, that's where the cool people, that's where the young people are at.
That's right. They're at the AEW of NFL is what we can call them. But the demo thing, I look at this stuff and I'm like, everyone just take a breath. Everyone gets so wrapped up in a number that they didn't understand 5 years ago, right? 3 years ago, whatever. And it's crazy. There's so many people that just, they live and die. And they're like, see, this proves my point. It's like, why are you so angry at NXT or why are you so angry at AEW? It's this weird, like, just sit back and enjoy it. I do not understand the back and forth. We have to pick a side. Actually, I do understand it because it's all from the political craziness of the past 4 years. I'm convinced that it's kind of polarized, the fact that every single subject in life you have to be polarized on. If it's your sports team, everyone else sucks. Your quarterback or everyone else sucks. Your pro wrestling, everyone else sucks. You can only like one. It's this weird like thing of like, everyone's so fixated on this stuff and maybe not, you know, taking a step back and look at, okay, what does it actually mean? But they want to declare victory with every single Wednesday. It's just like, guys, just relax a little bit, you know, have fun with expressing.
I think a lot of the hostility is not just that people are trying to interpret this or argue with each other. The medium is the message that we're doing this through Twitter, which is, where does Twitter make their money? Through advertising revenue, I think, almost all of it. And what makes you pay attention and give your impressions to Twitter? Well, having outrageous conversations where people feel very strongly about one thing, either good or bad, and it's in Twitter's interest, or at least there's whatever the business is that was going to come to be to cultivate this sort of hostile interaction. It was going to. I think that's just sort of the nature of social media, is that you know, what do people spend the most time on? It's they spend more time on what either is the opposite of what they think, and it makes them mad, or affirms what they believe. And I think it's just that this medium that we use, Twitter, it tends to make us very susceptible to it's sort of like a video game. I've heard someone say it's the outrage video game. You know, you got to look at your tweet and see how many points did I score. I sort of catch myself sometimes where I'm like, oh God, what am I doing? But yeah, maybe wrestling fans are predisposed to be a little bit more hostile, but social media and particular kinds of social media platforms like Twitter are make things even more intense. Mm-hmm.
So with AEW, I did one thing. I think so many people are trying to get like, you know, what does this mean for this? What does this mean for this? I think with AEW, it's way too early to tell what this could mean for them. They don't have their content library is like, what, probably 150 hours, 200 hours, something like that. So not a lot. But I keep thinking about this. I'm very curious what they're going to do with all of their Dynamites and really like the pay-per-views. Because right now you still have to buy, if you want to go see the first ever All In, you have to pay $50 to see it. You still have to go to BR Live and pay that full amount. And to me, it's just like, that's a waste, right? I assume that, you know, they have this relationship with Warner Media, and I don't know if they do an AEW hub there or something like an HBO Max. But you know, you could put it under something. That seemed to be the natural fit, is if you're going to put this stuff somewhere, you want to put it, and I know there's a bunch on BR Live, but again, you have to pay for the pay-per-views, that there's some sort of leverage they can get out of it. If you have, you know, if you're bringing in new fans and you want them to kind of go back in the archives, there's really not a clean place to do it. So that's kind of my, just kind of thinking out loud about stuff. I'm curious about when and where that's going to happen, and how that does. And maybe it's tied in with whatever this third hour will be. Maybe it's an announcement tied in with that, but they have, you know, they are building a library, and I'm always curious, like, these libraries are assets to somebody. So where is it going to be?
Yeah. I think at some point there's use to be made. There's money to be made out of charging people something reasonable to get access to an AEW library. Like you said, it's a very small library at this point. They've only been creating content since May 2019. But I think at some point it makes sense to put that library somewhere, probably in the Warner Media universe. But I think the pay-per-views are best monetized as they are. I think it's with the way the pay-per-views are with WWE today, I think it's sort of an accident out of the bold strategy and ambition of doing the WWE Network and going it alone and circumventing the pay-per-view splits, which, I mean, literally in terms of math, were not favorable to WWE. I think Vince wanted to, get around probably the roughly 45% split that he was having to take from, right, from the pay-per-view providers and do it himself. But I mean, the network was more profitable than pay-per-view. Problem is, it cost a ton of money to get the network going. But I think the history of the business and the history of pay-per-view tells us that using the pay-per-view model of charging $50 or $60 for a pay-per-view for a live program, that's very important, that it's a live program, is that price point is pretty inelastic relative to the volume of sales that you'll get. What does that mean? It means that, like, if you change the price of the pay-per-view, it doesn't affect the number of buys that you get very much. We saw that in the early days with the In Your House pay-per-views, where they were charging $15, which was half the price of the standard pay-per-view at the time. And eventually they just did away with that and charged 30 for all of them. And after a while it was up to 35 and so on and so on. So it got to $60, and WrestleMania was even higher, I think. But through all that, it didn't seem that the increase in pay-per-view price affected the sales very much. And I think that's just the evidence that the people who are buying this thing are a very hardcore base, and they'll pay a pretty high price for it. Obviously, there's a point where you do start to chase people off. But I think Berrios and Wilson, they came from they weren't wrestling people before they came to WWE, which is fine. But they I think they read WWE as being sort of like Netflix. Michelle Wilson tells this story about how when she started to work for WWE, she sat down and watched a Royal Rumble pay-per-view. And was confused that there were people that were paying $60 for this product or whatever the price was at the time, and it was a smaller audience. And if you think about that in terms of other sports, I guess it's like thinking about how the playoff games having a lower audience, smaller audience than the regular season. And I think they saw that as an opportunity to get more people into this product and to get more money out of them. But I think if you just look at the results, this is with the benefit of hindsight. If you look at the results, what was the peak for pay-per-view sales? Well, a WrestleMania would do 1 million buys, maybe a little bit more than 1 million buys. And where did the WWE Network peak out? At about 1.8 million. So it's not like they tripled the audience like they had been projecting. I think the lesson of this whole the 7-year ordeal is that, yeah, pay-per-view price doesn't matter as much as you might think it would. And I say that as somebody who is like, yeah, I'm never going to pay $60 to watch any TV show. I maybe with my friends, if we all get together and split it, but I'm not going to drop $60 to watch something in my home on TV. But I think we learned that the price point, the best way to monetize a pay-per-view event is through traditional pay-per-view. This is all to say that I think what AEW is doing right now, at least in terms of the live broadcast, is the optimal way to monetize it, to continue to charge as they do $50 for a pay-per-view. Again, I think at some point when they've got a big enough library, there's some money to be made in putting the library on demand somewhere. But yeah, I think maybe there's a third hour of AEW coming up soon, and I don't know. I would guess that's going to end up on on linear TV. That seems to be part of the deal with the deal that is giving them TNT. And I would imagine that's all a linear deal. I would look at where did AEW end up when it was preempted. And I think the first spot that it ended up when it was preempted was a Saturday with a lead in from an NBA game, granted, but a Saturday at 6. And I would guess that's somewhere in the Turner world. It ends up on a Saturday, maybe at 6, which is a familiar time slot for professional wrestling in the Turner world.
Very true. You mentioned prices of pay-per-views and UFC, no better evidence of that. The first month of the new price increase, up $5 to $69.99 plus a dollar increase for ESPN Plus for those that are, you know, paying month by month. So, and, but it didn't seem to matter. Reported 1.6, I believe. Yeah, 1.6 million buys for Conor McGregor and Dustin Poirier this past weekend. And obviously, as we mentioned earlier, that deal, ESPN is loving that, even though, you know, they're paying a flat fee. Events like this weekend to kick off a year is a nice little boost in the coffers and tremendous stuff for them. So, I mean, they're paying UFC a lot of money. NBC Universal paying WWE a lot of money. Fox paying WWE a lot of money. And this, the topic now, which is, people are talking about, and it's realistic because acquisitions have happen all the time, is look, if NBCU is paying paying WWE $2 billion already, and I mean, the UFC ESPN deal aside, you know, what's to stop them from being like, and perhaps they've entered these conversation of what can we do to actually just acquire the company, and when do we, when can we make that money back? And just, but instead of having to pay, just buy it outright and pay, you know, $5 billion, $6 billion, whatever the valuation is, and bring them into the fold, and then you, you own them forever. I mean, that, do you think that's a, I mean, I assume you probably, anything's a possibility, but, has that thought crossed your mind here as this latest $1 billion deal happens?
Very much. I mean, I felt that way, at least several months ago. I guess some of that was with it in mind that Peacock was a possible destination for a deal like this. But I think it would be in NBCU's interest to buy WWE. Like you said, I think it's better to own all this content rather than to lease it every year. But I think, you know, that's not going to happen in the lifetime of Vince. I think for Vince, first of all, Vince owns about a third of the shares, but his shares are Class B shares, and that gives him 10x voting rights on all of his shares. So the math works out so that he has about 79%, because I've been asked about this question recently, he has 79% of the voting power in WWE. So that means he has to sell a lot more of his stock to be in a position where he does not control the company. But I think if I were to psychoanalyze Vince, I think there is no amount of money that is worth giving up control of his company and primarily control of creative. I think that that's his life and that's what he lives to do, is to control this universe that he controls and to do the programs that he does. And I don't think there's any amount of money that's worth exchanging for that. Let's see, what's Vince McMahon going to do with his life if he? And I guess you could imagine a situation where, like, okay, well, let's just still be head of creative, but give us control of the company. I guess that's a possibility. That doesn't sound like a scenario that's going to work out well, though. True. If NBCU were to ask me, you know, what should we do? I think you should buy that damn company and get him out of head of creative. I think that's incumbent on you. If you have the USA Network, and granted, you're about to inherit a bunch of sports content from NBCSN closing up. But one of the reasons why, maybe the main reason why USA Network is as highly rated as it is because of WWE Raw. And I think on a long enough timeline, and I wish Vince McMahon the best of health, but on a long enough timeline, if he lives for a long, long time to come and continues to be the head of creative, I think it's only going to continue to drain the brand value of WWE Raw and of these other rights that you just bought. And I think it would behoove you to protect that brand value. And I think the best way to do that is to acquire the company from him somehow. I don't think any of this is really possible. And the XFL is even gone. So he doesn't have this other project to distract him or to take over his time and work ethic. But yeah, I think it would be in their interest to get a control of the company, to no longer have to essentially lease this content, to own it. I think that's the position that everybody in these streaming wars wants to be in. They want to own the content that they're selling rather than paying for it on a recurring basis. Mm-hmm. And I think it would protect the value that you're investing in this W content that is supporting your USA Network and now is supporting Peacock.
Yeah, that's a great point. Is control freaks, right? And I can definitely see, I can see it more with the UFC getting acquired simply because Endeavor owns them, so they've kind of taken out some of that that power away from Dana White anyway. And I can see them being like, look,
and Dana was never like a controlling owner, right? I think he owned part of UFC. You would probably know.
Yeah, like 10%, but he was never a majority. He had certainly influence because he was, you know, obviously best friends with the Fertittas and he was such a public figure, but in terms of the control factor, he does not have even near the control that he did before. And I think that's, you know, I've heard that from plenty of people there. It's kind of one of the reasons he drives some people nuts sometimes.
Yeah. And I think the way that NBC views it is probably, you know, this is a business that Vince knows and Vince dominated and we trust him to do whatever. And I don't think they at all perceive that, WWE is draining its popularity. I mean, I think they're comfortable with the ratings the way that they are. I know there's reports every now and then that USA, I think there was recently when they hit the latest all-time low that USA was unhappy. I mean, they're still highly ranked, and that is the key. When you look at that Showbiz Daily chart and you see WWE start to fall out of the top 10 or something, then it's time to be concerned. But, you know, on average, that program ranks number 4 or so. So I think and that's against NFL and a year in 2020 where there was a lot of highly viewed cable news programming. But, yeah, I think they're all right. Maybe after, you know, Vince is gone and the next generation is in control, then I could definitely see it being sold to somebody. And I think NBCU is the most likely and acquirer and the best fit.
Yep, I would agree. Let's round out the conversation with this, and I don't even know if you've seen this. Did you listen to the Undertaker Joe Rogan podcast at all?
No, I avoid all things Joe Rogan and all things Undertaker.
Okay, is that?
But I'm aware. I'm aware of the comments though. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know if that was a it's been a lifelong ban of the Undertaker. It's scared of people come from under the ground or something or not.
No. I've read some of the quotes, but I'm aware of the controversy around the conversation.
So I finally finished the show today. It's like 2.5 hours, so it's, you know, long and everything. But it's I'm surprised. And you've been in wrestling locker rooms, and one of the reasons I want to ask you this, obviously, is because you've worked a lot of different places and seen a lot of different wrestlers from different experience levels and you know, experience different locker rooms and things like that. I kind of listen to the whole thing. I think sometimes when people hear things, clips, they can take things kind of out of context or may not get, you know, what was the conversation leading into it and so on. But my takeaway was, you know, he's a 50-year-old guy that came up in an era that is much different than today. And I think for anyone that is, gets to a certain age and has an industry that is so bizarre as wrestling is, and if they were to talk about, to go back to, you know, 30 years earlier when they started, I'm sure anyone in any industry would think things were a lot different. They were a lot rougher, a lot whatever. And I think it's what happens when you get old. You talk about the good old days and you talk about how things were better. And I'm sure in some ways, if that conversation got a different direction, would say that things are better today because, you know, there aren't as many wrestlers dying. You know, there's not, generally it's healthier, and perhaps, you know, the video games versus the guns and the drugs is a much better thing. I just, I thought that, excuse me, getting choked up here. I thought that people are really just kind of want to go after him, you know, just for any way that they can. And just sometimes older people, they have their own they have their own opinions on stuff, and that's it. And no matter what anyone says, it's not going to change his mind. It's just, that was the way it was. And, you know, I was surprised to see, you know, younger, actually I wasn't surprised to see such a kind of a dust up about it, but, you know, kind of just focused on one thing and not saying, well, you know, look, he's 50 and came up in an era where things were a lot different. But I was just kind of curious, is, you know, from what you have heard, and
so you think it's kind of being blown out of proportion?
I do. Cause he's been, I mean, he's been around these younger guys, and it's not like, you know, the documentary or anything like that, or you don't hear stories about how people can't stand to be around him. You know, I don't think if he was a curmudgeonly guy, I don't think that, you know, Triple H would bring him around the performance center as much as he wants to. And he has been, and so on. And I think that, I think, you know, sometimes just old guys like to talk, you know, and they just like to talk about the good old days. And I think it's okay to say, you know, if you'd asked him a different line of questioning, maybe he would have come to their defense a little bit more and would have. And I can understand the talk about the kind of the masculinity part of it and kind of questioning guys and whatever. And I would like to see that explored a little bit more, because I think probably maybe his viewpoints wouldn't be as bad as maybe they came off. But I was just listening today. I was just like, it's an older guy talking about an older era, which athletes from every era do. They're always, look, 30 years from now, LeBron James is going to say this current NBA was so much harder than it is like when his kids are playing, right? And same thing with baseball, with football. This is just what old athletes do. The yesteryear was always better than the current day. But I was just kind of, you know, curious, as a guy that's been in locker rooms and in locker rooms all over the place and known so many wrestlers and so on, what, you know, kind of what your takeaways were from that.
I mean, I don't want to address it specifically because I didn't listen to it, but there isn't a broad overhanging sense and culture in pro wrestling that especially when I'm training people, I'm trying to, like, I don't know, there's so much in my podcast this past weekend I talked about this banking model, and my girlfriend is becoming a teacher, so she's telling me about the things that she's learning in her college classes. But there's like this idea of sort of this older traditional idea in teaching that you know, these students don't know anything, and I'm going to bestow my knowledge onto them, and it sort of creates this dynamic where the best student is the one who, you know, admits that they know nothing, and then who is most eager to take in the knowledge that you're bestowing upon them. And I think that's very much what pro wrestling, I don't know, training or the culture of, you know, listening to your elders who have, you know, great and useful knowledge for you to absorb and learn from. But I think where things get tense and conflicted and wrong is that, you know, for one thing, the way that people in a different era, and this may have nothing to do with the Undertaker said, but the way that people in a different era had to get over is in their era, to get over for the first time, they had to do X, Y, and Z. What people today have to do to get over for the first time is quite different than it was at your time and place, and it's what I have to do to get over in front of a new audience at a local indie show is different from what I have to do to get over the first time in front of a super indie audience at Limitless Wrestling, for example. Mm-hmm. What I have to do to get over in Japan is going to be different than it is in either of those two places. And I think where the older generation gets it wrong sometimes is that they act as if what it takes to get over for the first time in whenever, you know, say The Undertaker debuted in 1987 or whatever, is the same in 1987 as it is today in 2021, and that's far removed from the truth. As an indie wrestler, the example that I'm familiar with is, you know, you've got, you know, one of these legendary wrestlers who spent, you know, a number of years on television and is very well known to wrestling audiences. You know, that wrestler comes through the curtain and there's this huge pop. They're already over. What it takes to get over for the first time is something different, and that causes us to do things that the other generation didn't do, to do something that's new or different, or to, you know, to do too much stuff, and to not slow it down, to not sell. And there's subtlety, and yes, you can still be doing too much. You can still be not selling well. But it's a different thing, you know. Like you think of like the Vader criticism of I think like the Osprey and Ricochet match. It's a different they have to do something that is different from what you did to get over. And I can watch you, who is already over, go out there and have a match that gets really over, but you were already over in the first place. You got over 20, 30 years ago. And what I have to do to get over when nobody cares about me is a totally different thing. If you put on a mask, if some legendary wrestler who's you know, one of the names on the show put on a mask and nobody knew who he was, I think you would have a hell of a time getting over. I don't know, that's just one dynamic I see. And I think it's amazing sometimes how people who had so much success in the business, maybe like The Undertaker, who is, you know, one of the biggest stars in wrestling history, I think still seem to miss the big picture. And it's the quote that I read was that, you know, he sort of blamed the talent. And so I guess, you know, it must be the talent's fault. It could never be the people who actually have the power in WWE. It could never be their responsibility. And I think there's this sort of cycle of that you see. I think you see it in younger wrestlers as well. Of it's never the talent's fault. It's you know, or it's never the people in power's fault. You can't criticize your boss, certainly not publicly.
Right.
There's much to be gained by whether you believe it or not, or just internalizing and convincing yourself that. You know, it's not Vince's fault, or it's not the creative's fault that I'm not being used well or not getting over. It must be because these other people around me, or I'm not working hard enough. And I think that's probably happening in WWE. And I know what happens outside of WWE. That is a more useful psychology to have. And if you're ambitious, it's to your benefit to think that, and to I don't know, to think otherwise, or to say the things publicly, like, you know, people like you or me say would be a detriment to your career. So I think, you know, it's ambition that gets in the way of the truth a lot, because I have a personal ambition to get to WWE. So it's to my benefit to internalize a psychology that helps me survive in that environment, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you remember the most infamous comment, one of them, and the many, was the brass ring comment, right? Grab the brass ring.
Yeah.
And that the reaction that came out of that, and, you know, yeah, I think it echoes a lot of what you were saying and some of that frustration. Yeah, it's never, you know, some of these guys, it's never Vince's fault. It's not that, because they don't want to piss off the guy who signs the checks and makes the decisions, but they can just say, well, this newer generation or something like that. And yeah, it was it's an interesting discussion. I was interested to get your perspective on that, given, yeah, that you do train and you obviously wrestle yourself and seen a lot of things. And one of the things obviously making a difference, now they have to get over these damn streaming apps.
Yeah. I guess to go back, I guess one of the things that I try to tell people when I'm training them, and like, I'm not somebody who ever, I never wrestled in WWE or made $1 million in wrestling. I'm just somebody who's been around for a long time, and I've had a moderate amount of success on a very regional level. But I know some things, and I've studied the business really hard, and I've had a handful of matches that people say are good. And whatever I'm teaching you may or may not be relevant in a year or 10 years. And, you know, what one day, increasingly over time, the things that I know to be effective and true will become perhaps less effective and true. And, you know, we don't own the truth. We don't own what works and what gets over and what's effective. We're all trying to figure that out for ourselves, and it's always changing. I'm contractually obligated to credit Dave Meltzer to that, one of the things I remember him saying that I think is very true and useful is that, you know, the business is all, you can learn and learn and learn and learn and learn. But the thing that you can never forget that you have to learn is that the business is always changing. And if you forget that the business is always changing, pretty soon you're going to be left behind and you're going to be left out of how the business is changing. And there's going to be people who excel way ahead of you. And it'll be easy to tell yourself a story about how that's, they're really the people who are screwing up and they're doing a bad job, but they're going to be excelling ahead of you. And you have to always be wary and be aware of how the business is changing.
Well, Brandon, we'll never worry about you. We'll never leave you behind or anything like that ever again. You're always in our hearts and always be with all of us at all times, especially as we turn on our various streaming apps and think of you.
Yeah. If you don't keep up with the streaming universe and if Comcast doesn't keep up with the streaming culture that's happening, they're going to be left behind if they just stick to cable subscribers. They need the streaming subscribers too.
Or you turn into, is it Quibi? What was Katzenberg's stream service that just got sold to Hulu?
Quibi.
Yes. Quibi. You'll turn out to be like Quibi.
That's right.
Or oh my God, what was the social network that WWE invested in? Yeah. Tout app. Oh boy. Remember those days?
Yeah. I mean, you can always stream stuff on Tout. I think Daniel Bryan's still on there. Yeah.
Nice. Nice stuff. So before we let you go, been very generous with your time. Let people know how they can check out your work. You mentioned a podcast. I know you have a Patreon, social media. Give them the push. Give them the plug.
Yeah, I'm diversifying the media platforms that I am on. I have a website. There's WrestleNomics.com, where my written work is. There's a lot of resources that I'm trying to get up there. You know, things like what are the trends of W Network subscribers over time and TV viewership and things like that. That's on WrestleNomics.com. My written blogs are on WrestleNomics.com. There's some locked posts on Patreon.com/WrestleNomics. I did one just yesterday about all this Peacock WWE business. I have a Twitter, WrestleNomics, at Brandon Thurston also. I have a podcast, WrestleNomics Radio, that I do every weekend. At the moment, I'm doing it every Sunday. That's the schedule. And you can find that in your podcast app by searching for WrestleNomics.
And I do believe, if I remember right, you and Mr. Harrington, Mookie, you did recently, that was you, right? The minute-by-minute breakdown?
Yes.
That was you. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Chris Harrington is the founder, creator of WrestleNomics, not me. I merely inherited it from him. Mookie created WrestleNomics, and I think people who are familiar with the Observer site are familiar with Mookie. And we did the podcast together, and then we sent him off to future endeavors in All Elite Wrestling. And so you hear a lot about the news about the viewership and then even the quarter hours. And then you do hear a little bit of tidbits about this minute did this or that. But only the people deep inside AEW or WWE probably have access to those minute-by-minute data sets. And Mookie now, since he has been working for AEW, has access to those minute-by-minute data sets. And just, I think, when did we do that? We did that in December.
Ago. Yeah.
Yeah. But Mookie admitted that the reason why I chose to do this with you on this day is because the data looks really good and we can tell some favorable stories here. So that's what we're talking about there is he shared his screen, his Excel screen with us, and that is recorded on YouTube on the WrestleNomics channel. If you search for, I don't know, AEW NXT minute by minute viewership or something like that, it'll probably come up. It's about an hour and 15 or hour and a half discussion between Mookie and me and his screen. And I do not hesitate to ask him the tough questions.
Well, Brandon, I appreciate the time. Keep up the good work. Keep telling us what's going on. And yeah, I can't really say much more. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I'm glad to do it. Thanks for having me, Josh.
All right. Big thanks to Brandon Thurston for stopping by. It's hard to believe. I didn't know that he was the first podcast that he did was mine. I couldn't believe that. And look at him. He's all over the place. This week alone, we're joking about it earlier, that he did post-wrestling on Tuesday. He also did whenever the news broke. I think it was Tuesday, Monday. I honestly, this week, I'm not sure what is going on. But he did post-wrestling. He did Fightful as well. And he came on with me. So look at that. So yeah, hopefully that gave a little bit different perspective and different ideas from what I know Dave Meltzer's talked about on our website. And obviously maybe, you know, I purposely did not listen to Brandon's interviews with Post or Fightful. Just I wanted to kind of keep a fresh mind going into this. So hopefully that was good. Hopefully some interesting stuff. And yeah, fun, interesting times ahead. Two clarification points I wanted to make. One was the... on the AEW pay-per-view thing, I should have said this during this, but we were in the flow of a conversation. I wasn't saying that I don't think that AEW should do any pay-per-views at all. Contrary, I'm really talking about the archive stuff. Like, to me, you shouldn't have to pay $50 to watch All In, like the very first one, right? Or All Out. Okay, All In, All Out. I'm telling you, my mind is just completely screwed. I don't think you should have to, like, the first Revolution, like, who's going to go back and pay $50 to watch it from a year ago? You know, I'm just thinking you can try to get some value out of that. So that's kind of where my head was at with that. So again, in evidence by how great Conor McGregor's done, pay-per-view is hot again. And I mean, certainly, you know, no reason for AEW to go the full WWE network route. My thing was more, you know, what do we do with some of these archive pay-per-views so more people can see them and not have to pay, you know, $50 a month or $50 to go see something that's like a year and a half old. The other clarification point, and I was thinking about this actually driving after I dropped my daughter off for daycare today, which again, I don't know why this came into my mind. I think I was thinking about, you know, putting this together, was I should clarify, it's not that fans don't matter. It's that the aggregate fans matter much more than the unique fans, if this makes sense. So my rationale, aggregate means just the collective, right? So obviously WWE can't go to like zero fans because that would obviously not be good for business, no matter how much money they make. However, I think the individual whims of consumers for their product means less than it ever has because these deals are protecting them. When the individual whims perhaps catch on bigger and becomes the aggregate and becomes this much larger group, then it can start to matter. But with this fan base, their core, which is, you know, I guess you'd call it like around 1.8 million, give or take, something like that, could vary. You know, it doesn't seem to matter. There are some that hate watch WWE. There's some that just love WWE no matter what. And I think there's some people kind of in between. But to me, you know, when people complain about storylines or this or that, you know, the individual whims, the individual interest, that doesn't matter. Their opinions don't matter. It's the aggregate that matters. So I need to clarify that because I know I've talked about that with UFC before, also very insulated away, but much more, you can definitely tell the individual interest level depending on like pay-per-view buys, right? I mean, that's a huge indication because if somebody's actually clicking buy, then that's as much of a one-to-one transaction as you're going to get in order to say this person was interested. Now, the person could have eight other people in the room, but you kind of get the idea. WWE, that's not really like that. Obviously, they'll know the numbers, network streaming and all that. But with the storylines and things like that, it's the aggregate that really matters. And while the aggregate certainly is dropping, I mean, look, the aggregate has been dropping. It's down, I think we talked about, and I know Paul's talked about this, Paul Fontaine, and he does their ratings reviews and such. You know, the overall is like, you know, 23% down, 25%. It's going to be even more than that. I think it's in that range year over year for Raw ratings, right? And they still just earlier this week signed a $1 billion deal for all this old content and the ability to have, you said, the monthly pay-per-views and so on. So it's still going to be WWE no matter what. And yeah, the insulation factor is certainly something that you don't like to... It's weird. You don't like to see businesses get there. You can appreciate it because that's what the American dream is, right? But the other aspect when it comes to in fan engagement and our interest level, it's kind of frustrating because you like to think your voice matters. And it's more like unless the voice is aggregated, It doesn't seem to matter as much, if that makes any sense. So again, I was thinking about that, dropping off my daughter for preschool today. So yeah, the things that go through my mind. I think that is about it. I hope you guys have a great week. Again, this is a longer podcast, but hey, that happens. It's good. Good stuff. Thanks to all you guys for listening. You have a lot of choices in your podcast day, and I greatly appreciate the time you spend with me or any of the fine podcast guests here on WrestlingObserver.com. And that's it. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.